I asked in time again, take me in, draw the rein, 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 the rein, the rein, the rein, the rein, my rein now. David Goldstein.
And I'm Brian Brinkman.
You are listening to the Baker's Dozen Eve edition of Beyond the Pond. This is the podcast in which Brian and myself use the music of Phish to introduce the listener to non-jam bands that we think that they will like. We love Phish, we are Phish fans, but the problem with Phish fans is all they listen to is Phish, and that's a dreary existence, so we're going to do something about it.
This is our 10th episode. We've made it into double digits. We can't drink yet. We still can't vote. But we're getting somewhere. And we're going to focus this episode on the July 15th, 2017 Simple from Northerly Island in Chicago. This jam happened just about a week ago at airtime. And it was a fantastic first weekend jam for Phish in their summer 2017 tour. We are going to explore this through a couple of different themes, a few different songs, a few different bands, and we're going to chat a little bit about our thoughts on the Simple and a few songs that we think you guys will enjoy if you like the Simple.
Some of the themes that we're going to explore in this episode include badass riffs, staccato funk, and is Phish 2015 back? Let's try to find out. Let's get to the Phish.
Alright, 7/15/2017 Simple from Northerly Island in Chicago. So why cover this jam? Well, when we were talking about the first weekend and the first five shows of Summer Tour 2017, we really came to the conclusion that this was the most interesting jam from an absolutely stellar opening weekend of Phish 2017. This is 27 minutes long. It's multifaceted. This is the kind of jam that usually only comes later in a tour, and for it to come in the fourth set of the tour, second show, really portends big things with an MSG run looming.
Yeah, I mean, this Simple, well, first of all, this happened last Saturday. It was the second night of Summer Tour. But with this Simple, once you get, past the main Simple theme and past the Bliss, it kind of ends up being this really bass-heavy, like, progressive rock riff. And at one point, it sounds like they're clearly going to go right into Timberhoe, which would be cool in of itself. But they push through to some serious groove jamming. And they kind of end with a big major key peak and a flutter into Winter Queen. And, it's interesting in that it doesn't sound like anything you would expect from Simple, nor anything you'd really think of as coming of a Phish 3.0 jam. And usually with most Phish 3.0 jams and Phish in general, you can kind of follow Trey from point A to point B. It's like a flow. You can listen, you can see how he gets there, you can see the gears moving. But with this Simple, it's interesting because about 11 minutes it kind of winds down to almost nothingness, and you figure at that point Trail ripcord and they'll just go into something else. And then out of nowhere, Mike starts doing this really guttural bass riff, and then Trey comes back with this huge progressive rock riff that almost sounds like it could be composed. I mean, I almost think of more of, while this is a Fish podcast, it almost sounds more like something Umphrey's McGee would do, which is to say, play a composed bit, come to a complete stop, and then play something else entirely different and very proggy. So what it may lack from that point in continuity, it certainly makes up for in power and inventiveness, I would say. I guess talking about the tour and this run in general, the overall significance, I think we both agreed that it was a very, very strong opening weekend of summer tour. Thinking we almost compared it to, I guess, other powerful openings were summer 1997, going from Virginia Beach to Raleigh to Atlanta. Certainly summer 1998 with the Portland Meadows show, then the Gorge. And also in summer 2012, kind of starting oddly on a Thursday night in Worcester, that show was a barn burner. They really threw down at that show, said that we're not messing around. Fish is back in 2012. And in summer of 2015, the first three shows from the Bend shows and then Shoreline, especially, was very good. And then Forum in Los Angeles. Those are all very strong opening weekends. And we think that the three Northerly Island shows can practically stack up any of those.
Yeah, and then absolutely when you add in what happened in Dayton on Tuesday night and when you add in Pittsburgh on Wednesday night.
F yeah, Dayton.
Absolutely incredible second set in Dayton with Down with Disease, Ghost, and Wombat going pretty deep, and Pittsburgh having a fantastic Caspian and Mr. Completely return after 14 years. Just so you guys know, this is going to go live on Tuesday, July 25th, night four of the Baker's Dozen. So we're well aware we're not covering the first weekend of the Baker's Dozen. That will be in our next episode. But getting back to this first five shows of the run here, lots of debuts, something that we saw as well in summer 98, at least for the stateside fans, as well as summer 2015's opening runs. Something I thought really made these shows really stand out. In the good old summertime, a cappella tune that came midway through the first set of 7:14, Everything's Right, which was a great debut that I think we both really enjoyed. Leaves came midway through that first night second set, as well as Love Is What We Are and the encore. That first night was just a really bizarre set list with a ton of songs kind of seemingly out of place and a ton of songs debuting. And then Corona on the second night of Northern Ireland, and Thread debuting on the third night. I did dig Corona, and I really dig Everything's Right.
Yeah, Corona is a great song. Yeah. That's the first song on Trey's Traveler record. It's one of the better songs he plays with Tab. It's very well-composed, uplifting, big C major jam. I was very happy to see that. I liked Everything's Right. The jam sounds exactly like the end of Dry the Rain by the Beta Band, which is also the intro music to this episode. If Trey has finally discovered the three EPs, then so much the better. We're in for a treat because the Beta Band is awesome, and that's as good as it got for them.
And just to kind of wrap up the debuts from the first week, we had Tuesday, Trey Staple from 2005. That came out on his Shine LP, right?
Yes, Tuesday, second song on Shine, right, yeah. Yes.
And really enjoyable mic tune, Crazy Sometimes, with Fishman yelling behind him.
That was great.
In Pittsburgh, we had Marissa, another new mic-led song, and Rise, Come Together, which came out of Mercury in the second set, which I think placement-wise, I think it could have come in a better place. On re-listen, it sounded a lot better coming out of Mercury than it did on the original stream. But I think that has a really great place in the rotation going forward. I like that song a lot.
It could be used as a set closer. It could be a good encore.
spinning back around just to some highlights from the first five shows of tour. So 714, I think we can all agree, had a really strong opening set. And the tour in and of itself had a really strong opening set with that Everything's Right jam, What's the Use opener, and really, really great Limb by Limb and Blaze On to close.
What do we have in the second set? Was that the No Man's opener?
No Man's Open Up, 15-minute, very kind of minimalistic jam out of that that seemed a little similar to the end of that Wombat from the Nutter Center.
Right.
Your Pet Cat made an appearance into Golden Age and then back into Your Pet Cat, which for however long or however short they went away from the Your Pet Cat theme, I was happy to hear them start to experiment ever so slightly with the Chilling Thrilling song. 7:15, second night, had a pretty rockin' but standard set one. Corona opener, really great second set opener. Amazing simple that we're covering in this show. And then a fantastic Sense and Subtle Sounds into Cities. And Sense and Subtle Sounds on re-listen was very, very high-ranking jam for me from this tour. That just
that was about as type two as Sense gets. It was very minimalistic, almost like intelligent dance music, like some late '90s laptop type electronic groove.
Yeah, there's like that part where they almost do like a start-stop jam and Trey's playing what sounds like he's on a laptop. It's very high register, but lots of effects going on with it.
Right.
That was kind of, hearing that, it felt really easy for them to get into type 2 territory. And that was kind of a moment for me where I was like, okay, something else is going on here in terms of their jamming. They're really going for something different on this tour.
And then the third night, I think the first set of night three was your two 555 Ocelot. It's definitely the most standard 3.0 looking set one.
Yeah.
And then you had the Carini set two opener, the one you got past the dark and evil groove that it explodes into a variety of major keys. And almost pays tribute to the Reading Down with Disease. At times, it felt like they were taking like D major Allman Styles licks directly out of that Down with Disease and playing them at half speed, sort of giving it like a tropical flair.
Yes.
Sort of like you would take the Reading Down with Disease, but instead of running through a wall, you'd be laying back and forth in a hammock at some island resort with like a Man of Daiquiri or a Pina Colada.
And then so that ended weekend one, and we didn't quite know what to make of Dayton or Pittsburgh. Would they just be general sets as they prepared, you know, for MSG this weekend, or would they actually try to top themselves? And I think that we would say at least Dayton for sure topped, I would say, a couple of the shows in Chicago. Pittsburgh had some great moments and some great efforts as well. Nutter Center, I would say, contains one of the best set twos of the last year, and in some cases, possibly of the last couple of years.
Dayton's the one to beat.
Yes, I think that's the show so far.
And then finally, Pittsburgh last night. Very big Prince Caspian to close the first set. It's kind of almost challenged the Magna Ball Caspian in terms of rock majesty. I think I prefer the Magna Ball Caspian, but it was still very, very good. Maybe at least a top 10 version of that song. And Brian, tell us about the huge bust out.
Huge bust out, 20-minute plus jam off of Mr. Completely, the first since 7/15/2003, 380 shows. I think this is a song that at this point in time we had all just assumed was no more, that we had heard it once in Utah. Trey played it back when he was playing 45-minute long jams with Tab. It fit really well with the summer 2003 theme, but that was it. It was gone from there, and I was really, really excited to hear it come back. That was one of those moments where I was streaming and just kind of like chills, big smile, all the feels that you're looking for from a Phish summer tour. That's I would say my favorite jam of tour to this point. I re-listened to it today. It has moments where I feel like it channels that Hampton Carini from 2013, where it's just like candy grooves and just like peaks, and it's like they can't play a wrong note, and you just got to imagine the entire arena was just kind of vibrating, pulsating with hippies dancing.
Yeah, that was probably the most excited I've gotten streaming since Phish played last year at Bob Weir, and then I heard Fishman counting off playing in the van, and I was actually brushing my teeth at that time and almost swallowed my toothbrush and realized what was going to happen. But yeah, that was pretty exciting.
So some really great stuff all around. I don't think that we are speaking any sort of revolutionary language right now. Really great start to the tour. Everybody should be super excited going into MSG.
So now on this Baker's Dozen Eve, or you want to say Era of Baker's Dozen for those of the Jewish persuasion, what do you say about repeats? There's been a lot of stuff going around on Twitter and various Reddit groups and Fantasy Tour, what have you. People, they think that there's a chance that there might not be any repeats at MSG. I know that you and I have very, very differing views on this. What's your take to start?
So I read there was a really great article linked up on Facebook. I think it was on like Tuesday, where a guy went through and numerically figured out what would need to happen for there to be no repeats. And I didn't really see the point for them to put that much effort into it at that point in time. But I've definitely come around on it. Looking back at the five shows that have started the tour, I'm fully on board with there's not going to be a single repeat at MSG. I think it's a goal that they have in mind. I think that they intentionally came out and played these five shows the way that they did to test and see if it was something that they could do and to test and see if it was something that they really wanted to go for. And I think that with the success of these first five shows, plus just the sheer badass quality to playing 13 concerts in one venue and not repeating one song, kind of is in line with the no covers new year mindset that they went into 2013 with. It's a statement for the band, and I definitely think that it's going to happen. What say you, David?
I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, you really think they're only going to play one Tweezer in 13 shows? I mean, my feeling is, I mean, I want them to do whatever excites them, whatever challenges them, whatever they feel comfortable with. And I think that, I guess in the 3 or 4 show increments, like for example, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I wouldn't expect them to repeat any songs. But then when they take off that Monday, I think that'll probably reset the cycle somewhat. It just, for me to do no repeat strikes a little bit gimmicky, and it's something that's not how they've ever operated. So I think they want to do what makes them comfortable, what they think could be fun. I think that if they really try to do no repeats, it requires a lot of planning in advance, and it's a little too much on their mind, and it just would require a level of planning that I don't think they really need or want to do. And I think it would be too much about the gimmick and less about the shows themselves. Added to the fact that, I mean, what? At some point, they're going to have to stretch some non-jam songs out to like 15, 20 minutes. I mean, if they want to go and do like a 20-minute bouncing around the room, that seems to me is kind of strange and kind of forced. And I don't want things to be forced. I just want them to have a good time. And I think that no repeats would not necessarily be part of that. Let's make this interesting. If it turns out that Phish plays no repeats, David Goldstein, next time we hang out, we'll buy you, Brian Brinkman, a 6-pack of beer of your choice. If we go to a quality craft beer store and they have, like, you can pick your own 6, I'll even let you do that. Just because that's how much I care.
I will take you up on that.
All right.
And I will return the favor if they don't.
And on that note, let's listen to The Simple. We'll be right back. That version of Simple from July 15th, 2017 from Northerly Island in Chicago. So for the first segment of songs, we're going to discuss the power of the badass riff, which that Simple absolutely has at the very beginning of the jam portion, which we played. So when I heard this, the first thing that came to my mind was not so much metal, more so prog rock. Like progressive rock bands, especially the ones from the early 70s. So the first band and song I'm going to discuss here is one that is extremely near and dear to my heart. I'm talking about the Holy Trilogy of Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart, otherwise known as Rush. Now, frankly, we could have another 17 podcast episodes that's just Dave Goldstein talking about Rush, because that'd be very, very easy for me to do. I mean, normally we take all kinds of notes and research from Beyond the Palm, but I'm just doing this totally off improv because I can. So when most people think of Rush, they think of the early 80s stuff like Tom Sawyer and Limelight and The Spirit of Radio and, you know, any number of songs you could hear on classic rock AOR stations. And those are all fantastic. We could talk about the different phases of Rush, how they kind of start off as Zeppelin copyists, then had their huge concept album phase, and they started to worship the Police. But in particular, what I kind of want to talk about briefly is a part of Rush's history that a lot of people other than the hardcore fans really don't pay much attention to, which is the records that they put out in the 21st century, all of which were pretty good. Starting in 2002, they put out an album called The Vapor Trails. It was sort of their big comeback. It was the first they put out since 1996. Then I think in 2007, they put out an album called Snakes and Arrows. And in 2012, they put out what now looks to be their swan song, a concept album called Clockwork Angels. And the song that I'm going to play for you a little bit is called The Headlong Flight. And the reason I picked this song is it has a very heavy Geddy Lee bass riff leading into extremely badass riff by the guitarist Alex Lifeson, which actually harkens back to their 1975 song Bastille Day. And really, for them at their age to make an album as good as Clockwork Angels in 2012 was really something else. It was a concept album involving some sort of wanderer into a world of evil watchmakers. I think they may have even published like a comic book to go alongside this record. But, you know, it comes from an era of the band that's often overlooked, but they were very good at staying somewhat modern. I know they hired this producer, Nick Rasculinitz, who I think was also Foo Fighters producer, and he's heavily featured in Dave Grohl's Sound City documentary. So he kind of got them to harken back to their more 70s riff-heavy sound. And it's actually an extremely badass rock record coming from a bunch of dudes that I believe at that point were in their early 60s. And after they did a big 40th anniversary tour, and they're kind of on, they never formally announced a breakup, but Neil Peart, the drummer's got some terrible arthritis in his wrists and arms that I think keeps him from wanting to go on tour, and they all have families, so I think that could be the end of the road. But at any rate, let's listen to Headlong Flight by Rush off the Clockwork Angels album, which I highly recommend. And if you want to seek me out at a show or at me on Twitter and talk about Rush, then I will be more than happy to do so.
Thank you for that. Really tied in to the riff that Trey was laying down there in the simple, fantastic song from Rush. Keeping with the theme, we're going to talk about a relatively new band that I believe as well has sang their swan song, though it hasn't really been announced. This is San Francisco's Citay, spelled C-I-T-A-Y. They're a San Francisco band. They recorded on Dead Oceans. They were formed in 2004 by Ezra Feinberg as a studio project solely with Tim Green from the group The Fucking Champs. This band, think Led Zeppelin rock riffs, Beach Boys style vocals, Grateful Dead vibe. They are, and the song that we're playing here is called Careful With That Hat, off of their 2010 record Dream Get Together, their third record. This song that we're going to play kind of symbolizes everything that you get from a classic Citay song. There's a very recognizable guitar riff that just kind of annihilates you from the start. And then this kaleidoscope of melodies and noise and vocals come in, and there's layered vocal harmonies that come in midway through. It's a really, really beautiful sound, but it's also equally a very aggressive sound. It's kind of prog rock in a sense, but it's also got a very fishy vibe to it, if you will. Their songs are typically long instrumental sections dominate them, and then the kaleidoscope type of vocals come in to form this very psychedelic pop rock sound that I've just always greatly enjoyed. I first discovered them when I was in Korea in 2009 through our favorite message board Fantasy Tour. Immediately hit me exactly what I was looking for at that point in time, from a kind of guitar experimentation, very melodic type of sound. I've always just found myself coming back to this record. They're somewhat kitschy in the kind of same sort of way that Fish is sometimes, when Fish is in a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek mood. They're often self-indulgent in the best ways. You don't feel like these songs really leave anything on the table, and they're really there's nothing really nuanced about a lot of these songs, but their records are expertly produced, and they're really just like a fuck-off summer rock album. Just kind of whatever, just kick any responsibilities aside. They're the kind of record that you want to just drink a beer to or drive a car really fast to. Like I was saying when we started talking about them, I'm fairly certain that they've ceased to exist aside from a few one-off gigs. I have always wanted to see them, but there's little to no info about their tours or future records, recording patterns online. So if anyone has any information about Citay, about the happenings of Citay, I would love to hear about it. I would absolutely love to see this group, even if I had to travel for it. We're going to play Careful With That Hat right now. Hope that you guys enjoy this.
Okay, Brian, thank you for that song. I was actually, I did not realize that Cité was associated with the fucking Champs. That's certainly a band I listened to a bunch in the early 2000s and their crazy array of Led Zeppelin riffs. So continuing on what I thought to be the prog rock theme for this portion of the simple, I'm going to talk about the band Yes. And the song I'm going to talk about is The Fish, not The Fish from Vermont, but The Fish, F-I-S-H. It is an instrumental from their Fragile album, a.k.a. the album with Roundabout and Long Distance Runaround on it. It's probably their most accessible album aside of their 90125, which came out in 1983, and that's the one that's got Owner of a Lonely Heart and Leave It. It was their big 80s comeback album. So, yes, they've got lots and lots of records and lots of members. I think there's 19 different individuals in this world that can say they are once official members of Yes. And the only member that was in the band at the very beginning and survived every line of change was the bass player Chris Squire. And I think his nickname was The Fish. He wrote this instrumental, and unfortunately, he died 2 years ago, which was sad because he had an incredibly unique, very burbly bass sound that I kind of like to describe as a bunch of rubber super balls is being thrown out into the world because just it bounces. His bass lines bounce like no other. He uses a pick. He's very, very dexterous. And charting, yes, lineup changes, that can be an entirely different podcast in of itself. But this version of the band featured John Anderson on vocals, Steve Howe on guitar, Bill Buford on drums, Rick Wakeman on keys, and Chris Squire on bass. The era with Trevor Rabin and Alan White and Tony Kaye that produced Owner of a Lonely Heart, that would come much later in the 80s. So with Yes, you get John Anderson's choir boy vocals, endlessly bubbly bass patterns, huge riffs, lots of time changes, not to mention ridiculously long suites and long song lengths. The Umphrey's McGee 2009 album Mantis is essentially them just trying to recreate a Fragile era Yes album. Whether they would agree with me or not, it's true. And what's kind of funny about this band is that Yes recently they put out seven different live albums from their fall 1972 tour. Unlike the Dead's Europe 72 tour, each one of these albums all has the exact same set list. And I've listened to them on Spotify and I've tried telling apart versions and I can't. like Roundabout is within 5 seconds of 8 minutes and 40 seconds on each of the albums. So I don't really know why they did this. Like they sound good live. Maybe it was to just show off the precision. I don't know. It's kind of funny, but everything about Yes is excessive. So it makes total sense because they're very fun, totally overblown, but they made some fantastic songs, and nobody sounds like Chris Squire does. Thus, this tribute to him. So we're going to play The Fish off of the Fragile album. We'll be right back.
All right. So taking a break here from really aggressive rock and roll arena rock riffs. We are going to take a step back and talk about some new music that's come out. Obviously, our last episode, we focused on our five favorite records of the year thus far. And the year continues to move forward, and there's been some great music that's come out since we recorded, as well as in the time right before. So my record that I want to talk about from recent weeks is the new Fleet Foxes album, Crack Up. I've been listening to this pretty much when I'm not listening to Fish these days. I listen to this record. I absolutely love it. And had it come out probably 2 weeks earlier, it would have definitely made my top five at this point in time. This is the third Fleet Foxes record and their first since 2011's Helplessness Blues. And this one is called Crack Up. This is easily the most interesting album I've listened to all year. I was definitely wooed by Fleet Foxes in 2008 and early 2009. I just moved back to Chicago from Montana, and they just sounded like college to me, and they sounded like so many small little music festivals I used to go to. And, you know, about a year after the record came out, I kind of grew a little tired of it. I felt like I'd heard a few of the singles everywhere. And when I knew that they were coming out with their sophomore album, I didn't have very high expectations for it. And then Helplessness Blues came out, and it hit me at that really just perfect point, mid-20s. I wasn't really working a job I wanted to work. I wasn't exactly sure what was happening in my life at the time. I was about to get married, and Helplessness Blues really sung to the kind of existential fears of a 26-year-old. This record, Crack Up, I don't know if I relate to yet. There's a lot of lyrics on here that require a lot of repeated listening. There are a lot of references to Civil War era generals as well as Roman emperors. But I do know that I am constantly intrigued and constantly fascinated by the sounds that come out of this record, by the few one-off lines that I catch here and there, and just by the just complexity of the album overall. The opener, I'm All That I Need, followed by Cassius, 3rd of May, If You Need Me, Keep Time On Me, Fool's Errand, and I Should See Memphis have really become some of my favorite songs of the year. And not only do they each contain sections of just pure, pure melodies that I just keep getting stuck in my head, but they have all these other one-off kind of almost experimental, seemingly throwaway, but you know, somewhat fitting sections of music that make the song whole and give it kind of a totally different perspective. So this record really, really has won me over in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I know we've got a lot of stuff coming here by year's end, but I could see this in my top 10 by the end of the year without question.
I have to give that Fleet Foxes record one more chance. I know I love the first album. I liked Helplessness Blues enough. And when the third one came out, I know it sounded beautiful. The production was immaculate, but it's almost like an hour long, or even like a little over an hour.
Yeah, it's 55 minutes. So yeah, it definitely requires your attention. Definitely requires your time and attention.
Yeah, my 37-year-old attention span for studio albums is not what it is for Fish Jams, unfortunately. That's not Fleet Fox's problem. That's my problem. But I need to give it more time. And there's so many records and so much information that I kind of haven't given it the time it really deserves, which I have to
Plus, Fish is back on tour, so how are you going to
exactly?
Find
out? No, that's we jest, but it's true. Fish Jams take up time. They like take time away from other bands, which is why we have this podcast, to keep you focused. So the record I'm going to talk about is the new album from Haim, H-A-I-M, called Something to Tell You. For those in the know, Haim is three sisters from Los Angeles. It's Alana, Esty, and Daniela, I believe. Or just Daniela, I'm not entirely sure. So their first album came out in 2013 called Days Are Gone. And that album was kind of out of step in its time in that it was immaculately produced 80s Fleetwood Mac fantasy camp. So if hearing these young women in their 20s recreate 80s Fleetwood Mac was your thing, it was a fantastic record. That is totally my thing. Days Were Gone was excellently written, great production, great vocals, just an absolutely classic pop album that, despite not really being, I guess, in step with what was going on in the mainstream, I thought was endlessly enjoyable. And it took them 4 years to put out the follow-up, and the new one is, you know, kind of more of the same, but if there's no point in fixing the formula, then, you know, I'm plenty happy with more of the same. There's songs in there that sound so much like Christine McVie jams from 1987, you feel that she should be credited on the track. And really, I mean, I like 80s Fleetwood Mac. I have a thing for 80s AM gold and really well-produced albums. There's lots of ear candy. They make use of things like pitch-shifted vocals, different drum patterns. I believe it's Alana Haim is mostly the lead singer and guitarist, but they all take turns on vocals. And it's just, it's pure ear candy. And if that seems to be your thing, then you should be listening to this album right away. It's Haim, Something to Tell You.
All right, so transitioning our second segment here, we are going to talk about some staccato funk riffs while still keeping in mind the riff portion of the podcast. So if you listen to the simple in the section that we played, it goes very, very quickly from that heavy, heavy progressive rock riff into almost like a Timberhoe jam. It really sounds like Phish was going to go into Timberhoe, and I would say within the last 8 months, they would have gone back. They would have gone into Timberhoe. But then it keeps moving forward into this kind of staccato section that fills out that midsection of the jam. And so we've got two songs that we think would be really good fit for this. The first one is from an artist and an album that we featured before, but because it's Brian Eno, he should be featured as many times as possible until you become obsessed and listen to his entire discography.
Yes.
He is an absolute, absolute living legend. This is Sky Saw off of his 1975 record, Another Green World. This is the opening track to his third record. I remember the first time I heard this was in October 2009. Phish was killing a bunch of albums leading up to Festival 8. I threw on Another Green World because it was on that chart and it lasted a couple of rounds. And I knew Brian Eno because he produced a couple of my favorite U2 records, but I didn't really know Brian Eno. And so I threw on Another Green World and this Robert Fripp opening line, it just completely sucked me in, and I've been obsessed ever since. So this record featured Phil Collins, featured John Cale, featured Robert Fripp, and the opening line, the riff that ushers in this record is really the kind of separation between what Eno was doing before he was a solo artist and his ambient experimentation that came later in his career. And Robert Fripp, I know that we've mentioned him before. We talked about him in episode one in regards to the Camden Chalk Dust and the kind of style that that was. Robert Fripp is the lead guitarist or is the lead guitarist of Kim Crimson, which is a longtime favorite group of Trey's. And Robert Fripp is a guitarist that if you like Trey's playing, you will like Robert Fripp. He is a huge influence on Trey and really one of the pioneers of kind of soundscape guitar playing. Fripp pioneered a style that's known as Fripptronics, which essentially is the idea of looping a guitar. He essentially invented the guitar loop. And his guitar lines have this kind of repetition to them. There's a little bit of staccato throughout, but there's very much of like a atmospheric ambient soundscape to them that you hear throughout Another Green World. This song, Sky Saw, features instruments constantly changing their structure. It's a really dizzying sort of entry to the album. There's this very powerful riff, and then you kind of fall down the rabbit hole into the Another Green World that Eno's writing about. It's almost funky. It's somewhat nearly danceable. The beat throttles behind synths, behind guitars, and what can really be only described as Eno vocals. This is, think James Murphy on Get Innocuous trying to do his best Eno impression. Like I said, this was a true turning point for Eno in his career. This was his abandonment of attempting to write pop songs and focusing on textures, soundscapes, and true musical experimentation. In short, this is when Brian Eno became Brian Eno. And really, if you've ever had any interest in like kind of weird experimental noises, sonic atmospheres that color records like Heroes or The Unforgettable Fire or the Dune soundtrack or numerous Genesis recordings or the Microsoft opening sound or even that weird 2008 Coldplay LP, if that's your thing.
What was it, Viva La Vida?
Viva La Vida, the roots of all
good albums.
Yeah, yeah, had some really good points. The roots of all those albums, of all those sounds, come from Brian Eno and come specifically from this record. What's more, this guy just spawned a legion of imitators who have sought to alter modern rock music through experimentation and a widening of the overall landscape with which musicians, pop musicians, essentially could explore. So this is Sky Saw.
Okay, continuing our discussion of staccato funk, I'm going to talk about the organist Jimmy Smith. So basically, everything that you know about the Hammond B3 organ as a lead instrument can be traced to Jimmy Smith. I think he was born, I want to say, 1928 or thereabouts, and in his early 20s, he was rumored to have purchased a Hammond organ, rented a warehouse, locked himself in the warehouse with the organ, and then came out a year later, sort of supercharged and ready to go. He was incredibly prolific. I think he recorded nearly 40 sessions of Blue Note Records over 8 years, starting in 1956. He was dubbed the Incredible Jimmy Smith. And on the cover of his classic album, The Sermon, he's got his, now he's wearing a turtleneck, he's got his arms stretched, this look on his face like, hell yeah! Like, he knows he's good. So, and Fish knows he's good because I know Fish, they covered the standard Back at the Chicken Shack, I think a number of times in 1999, maybe in 2000. I don't have the time to go consult right now. Most of the things that he recorded in the 50s and 60s are varying degrees of excellence. Some of my favorite records include the aforementioned The Sermon. I know he recorded two albums with the guitarist Wes Montgomery in the early 60s for Verve Records. He put out one with Kenny Burrell, the guitarist, called Organ Grinder Swing. And the one I'm going to discuss here is from 1972 called Root Down Live. So, in the 1970s, he moved out to Los Angeles. In 1972, he cut this live album at a club called the Bombay Bicycle Club. And it's very much rooted in early 70s funk and R&B. It even includes an instrumental version of Al Green's Let's Stay Together, as was common at the time, was to cover what was on the radio. So you probably heard the song Root Down and think of the Beastie Boys, because basically the Beastie Boys song on the Ill Communication album was then kind of sampling down and adding some beats and lyrics. So the original, what you hear in the Beastie Boys album, this live album has that original version. And the song we're going to play here is called, the first song on that album, it's called Sag Shooting His Arrow. And people are a little bit less familiar with this than they are Root Down. And it is absolutely smoking, fiery, staccato funk in spades. And while it doesn't sound a heck of a lot like the staccato funk jam in the version of Simple, it is it's there in spirit. And what's interesting about Jimmy Smith is that he was really playing right up to his death in 2005. He was 79 years old when he died, and he was actually on tour. And I think he didn't show up for rehearsal, and they went back, and they just found he died in his sleep in his hotel room in Scottsdale, Arizona. So if you enjoy the Hammond B3 organ, and I know you do, I know Paige McConnell certainly does, you could do much worse than seek out some Jimmy Smith. So we're going to play Sag Shooting His Arrow from the Root Down Live LP.
Smith there. So we want to thank you guys for listening to our 10th episode here. We focused on the Northerly Island Simple from July 15th, 2017. Hope that you guys are enjoying the Baker's Dozen shows that have already happened and are enjoying the Baker's Dozen show that's going to happen tonight. Just taking a step here, looking back on the songs that we featured. So we started off with Rush with Headlong Flight, moved right into Cité with Careful That Hat off their 2010 record Dream Get Together. Yes, The Fish, tribute to Chris Squire, was up next. We moved into our second section here, staccato funk riffs as opposed to purely badass funk riffs. Or badass riffs, I should say. We had Brian Eno's Sky Saw off of 1975's Another Green World. Be interested to hear what the next Another Green World track is we pick in the future here. And Jimmy Smith ended things for us with Sag Shooting His Arrow. Really just fantastic display of the Hammond B3 organ.
So, if you like what you heard here and you want to shout back at us or have some other riffs that you think we should hear or just want to say that we're full of crap, please feel free to do so. We got social media links. We're on Twitter @_beyondthepond, on Medium, medium.com/beyondthepond. And what we do is we have a Spotify playlist. It's under the Beyond the Pond podcast songs. I think if you're paying for Spotify, you should be able to find it pretty easily. It's not quite as easy to find the free version, but at us, we could definitely put it, help you find it. What we do is that we try to put up all the songs we featured in the episode in the Spotify playlist. Now that we are 10 episodes in, the playlist is getting quite robust.
Absolutely. And so this episode, obviously coming out here on July 25th, our publishing structure really works out nicely with every other Tuesday. So we're going to come back here in two Tuesdays, which should be August 8th, where we will be discussing the Baker's Dozen in full. I'm picking a gem from that. And based off this summer tour thus far, these first five shows in the Midwest, we should have a lot of jams to pick from. So definitely come back for episode 11 in a couple of weeks here.
I know I am excited because I am going to the Baker's Dozen show tomorrow night.
Absolutely. That'll be,
yes.
Be webcasting this weekend, and then I'll be up there the second weekend. I can't wait.
But at any rate, very much, if you got to this point in the episode, we thank you very much for listening. We hope that your Baker's Dozen summer shows are enjoyable ones. And on that note, I'm David Goldstein.
I'm Brian Brinkman.
And tune in two Tuesdays and come back and join us, for we will once again go beyond the pond.